say I'm moving too slow. People say I'm moving, what the fuck do they know?
Okay, so I am here with Steve Stern, who is most recently the author of The Book of Mischief. And we are outside a place that is playing bagpipes for someone who we believe is dead. But Steve, how are you doing? You're quite alive, I see.
Well, I got, you know, 1.5 feet in the grave, but...
Oh, really? Okay.
Well. I don't know. I'm a very lively undead author.
Okay. Who deals with the dead quite a bit. You know, Frozen Rabbi, there's some, you know, well, at least it's frozen there. Which would be the ultimate metaphor of this kind of thing, yeah.
My characters tend not to stay dead, you know, but...
Despite your best efforts,
Well,
let's talk about some of the qualities of your work. One intriguing quality about your fiction is the way in which you have this idea of being Jewish aligned with these fantastical elements. The Frozen Rabbi, you have this kid named Bernie. He's constantly having to remind himself of his faith because he has this thought-out rabbi that he has to deal with, even as the rabbi becomes more craven and commercial as we learn more about his existence and we go back to the past. And then a story like Avigdor of the Apes, it sees its title character transform as he reads the secular, decidedly secular Edgar Rice Burroughs. You have Lazar Malkin Enters Heaven, which takes much of its influence from the story of the Golem, as well as this premise of this stubborn father-in-law who, as like what we're talking about here, refuses to die. So, you know, I'm wondering, when you come up with a fantastical element for a story, are you thinking in terms of Jewish identity, or does the Jewish identity tend to come along the more you think about the story or the more you tend to write about it? You know, how important is it for that fantastical element to work on some moral or thematic level?
You want the long answer or the short
one? Well, feel free to be as long-winded as you like on this program.
Well, truth is I grew up with virtually no Jewish identity.
Yeah.
I was... raised in a Reform synagogue in Memphis in the 50s and 60s during a time when the Jews in the South were trying their best to be invisible.
Yeah.
So Reform Judaism was a lot like Lutheranism, I think, in those days. You know, the rabbi wore ecclesiastical robes. He had choirs in robes, pipe organ, very little Hebrew in the liturgy. And, you know, so I pretty much was confirmed, not bar mitzvahed, and then walked away from it virtually untouched by heritage tradition.
What kind of reading of Jewishness did you do
none.
During this time? None whatsoever?
Absolutely
not
none.
Not even a scrap of the Torah here and there?
No. In fact, you know, I wasn't sure that the Torah and the Bible were the same thing, you know. And so, yeah, and I was, if an Orthodox anything, I was a hippie, you know, for years, and lived a kind of counterculture life, and... you know, always was a reader, so I certainly read, you know, Bello, Roth, and Malamud, and I came, I think, to more sort of traditional Jewish work, Yiddish books in translation, through a non-Yiddish writer, but Russian Isaac Babel, and, you know, in his world of the sort of Odessa ghetto, was an easy seg into reading about the shtetl and
yes.
Isaac Singer, and then, you know, becoming interested in Yiddish literature. But truth is, I was well into my 30s, and I'd come sort of full circle back to Memphis and kind of washed up there.
Yeah.
Couldn't find a job. Went to work for a folklore center. Where I was transcribing oral history tapes of Beale Street and Beale Street characters, old black blues men, promoters, you know, people that remember the heyday of Beale Street, which was fascinating to me because present-day Memphis was a bit of a wasteland. And it turned out that there was this Jewish component on the street, the pawn shops, the dry goods dealers. And
this would be old Main Street then.
Well, Beale off of Main.
Yeah.
And there was a kind of symbiosis, you know, between the black population and these Jewish merchants. And first I'd heard of it, really, and I, you know, all before my time, and I was fascinated. And
Did you read a lot about, like, the Jewish gangsters who crop up in a few stories here and in The Frozen Rabbi?
Was that... At this point, I'm pretty much tabula rasa, know. And so, you know, they said, well, he's local, he works cheap, and he's a Jew. So they assigned me to do this. I became the ethnic heritage director. I was suddenly elevated. And in researching the roots of the old Jewish community, which, again, I'd known nothing about, it turned out that there had been an authentic East European ghetto community on North Main Street in Memphis, which was the other end of town. So I went about with a big Nagra tape recorder, knocking on doors and finding old folks who'd grown up in this neighborhood, which
is a one-man federal writers project.
Yeah, in a way. And working on a grant, and, you know, and hurrying, you know, to try to gather information before the grant ran out, and you know, it turned out that the stories were fascinating, and I'd say, you know, well, how did he get here? And, you know, so they generally begin in the old country, you know, and then bring their tradition with them, and the tradition involved a lot of lore, you know, aside from the religion itself and the culture, you know, there was a literature attached, there was a folklore attached, you know, there were 1,000 years of just traditional stuff that I knew nothing about, so... Yeah. I fell into that world kind of like down a rabbit hole, you know, and thought, wow, here's a place I can set my stories, which had been kind of homeless before, and here's a culture. You know, I grew up in the South. My friends were, you know, all in the tradition of Faulkner and Flannery O'Connor, Eudora Welty, you know. I love those writers, but it was not a tradition that I could ever connect with. And I thought, whoa,
this... You needed a heritage then, and this kind of came out of the blue. Well, were you trying to write fiction before this?
I'd been writing fiction for years, you know, for a decade. And
it just didn't hit until you had that folklore element.
Well, I had this wonderful day, you know, when... I had a novel and a book of stories that were just kind of traveling around New York, and the agent called to say, well, you know, I've just had another rejection of your books, and the truth is, I'm not very enthused either.
Jeez, why did this agent take you on?
3 minutes later, you know, I get a phone call from the schools that I've been adjuncting at saying, you know, the enrollment's down and your presence will not be required, and it's desperate. So the
all doors shut at you at the same time.
Yeah, and I mean, to be honest, you know, I think in, you know, sort of redacting my life, you know, you look for a way to find elements or events that spell destiny, you know, and so the Folklore Center and, you know, the Discovery of the Pinch has that kind of feel for me. But, you know, on the other hand, I'm romanticizing and twisting the facts in a way to make it seem like a good story.
We've strayed quite a bit from my initial inquiry, which is totally fine, because I like this answer.
Are coming back to it.
Oh, I see. So how do we get from folklore to fantastical elements? That's the question.
Well, because in beginning to explore this, you know, this heretofore unexplored heritage, I began to discover a thing that I had never known about Jewish tradition, and that's that it has this incredibly rich, incredibly vast, you know, and diverse folklore that includes all kinds of magic, you know, and
was the magic, that was a big element for why it hit to you, why you could connect with it?
I'm an old hippie, you know.
It was either that or getting stoned all day.
Well, that too, but, you know, I've been I've been led to believe that the tradition that I grew up in was completely dry as dust, sterile, antiseptic, and it was as if, you know, I had sort of stolen into the attic of this old, you know, Methodist synagogue and discovered, whoa, here's a dibbuk.
Yeah.
You know, a possessing demon. Here's a golem, you know, a Jewish Frankenstein. Here's, you know, a wandering soul, you know, a fallen angel, all this.
So did you know anything of shuls or Shabbos or wedding canopies or breaking the glass, anything along those lines? Because your fiction is very, obviously very Jewish. Was most of that informed by all this folklore that you were soaking up during this time of discovery here?
Well, sad to say, and don't tell Cynthia Ozick, but it's all book learned, you know. And I've had very little firsthand experience of authentic Jewish community.
Really? Even recently?
No, I mean, because of what I've written, you know, I've been mistaken for a Jew these many years. And, you know, I had this operation so that I had the nose extended. But, you know, so I invited to teach in Israel. That was eye-opening. You know, I've spent some time in Prague and this past summer, Lithuania, you know, in Vilnius. And, you know, so actually touching at least some places where the Judaism is either vital or used to be.
Yes.
So, you know, I mean, it can't help it but fuel me a bit. But, you know, on the other hand, I'm 97 years old, and I thought I was just kind of passing through, you know.
Yeah.
I still have friends from the old days that say, you know, Stern, when are you going to drop this Jewish masquerade? And I think, well, I just, you know, one more story, you know, and then I'm going to write about the upwardly mobile, you know, Gentiles standing around a kitchen talking about their relationships.
Yeah, but everybody could do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
To go back to my initial question again, you know, I had observed how the fantastical elements became almost revealing in how these characters think about their Jewishness and their place. And this goes back to what I was hoping to get from you. You know, do you need a fantastical element to have this moral heft or this thematic expansiveness in order for you to write a story that you're going to get jazzed about that is actually going to fill up the page? I mean, how does this work exactly?
Yeah, I mean, I ask myself that because it's true that, you know, strict realism is not my medium. And often a story will begin with an image, and often that image will involve some element of the fantastic. But I think it works more at a sort of visceral level, you know, where characters are always torn between two worlds, you know, and whether it's the, you know, the ordinary and the extraordinary, or, you know, the pedestrian world versus the, you know, a place that's informed by the imagination, or solitude versus community. I mean, these dichotomies, which are inescapable, tend to become pretty literal in my mind. So that, you know, if you have making a distinction between two worlds, then one is going to be commonplace, and the other one is going to involve the kinds of elements and events that can't take place in an ordinary life. And so characters who are often trying to strike some balance or synthesis or to commute, you know, without damage from one world to the other, they often fail, or if they succeed, they succeed in some sort of paradoxical way. But then the truth is, what I love about fiction is that you can't have it both ways, you know. You can't embrace a paradox and have a character who is maybe able to live simultaneously in two worlds, or at least to make the attempt, you know. And so I think that's a theme that has been pretty consistent in my work. And
does this account for some of the extreme behavior that is often in your work? I think of Moshe the Just, which is quite wild.
Yeah.
Or for that matter, in The Frozen Rabbi, you have this sort of comic calamity in the present, 1999 to 2000 and whatever, versus this extreme barbarism in the past. I mean, it seems to me that you're a guy who really goes after those extremes. Is this kind of tied into this desire to pursue, you know, divisions and dichotomies and so forth?
Well, it's partly a desire not to bore myself or a reader,
yeah.
You know. But here's where I've had so much coffee that
no worries.
The brain moves faster than the mouth.
Yes, I understand. Or vice versa sometimes.
Yeah, vice versa often, especially, you know, in my age. But I also like the collision, you know, between these sort of various dimensions of human experience. And where morality comes in, I'm trying to get back to your original.
Oh don't worry about that. Don't worry about that. I'll be happy to steer you back if you stray. Feel free to ramble.
I hope you can edit the.
Yeah. I mean, I edit these things a little bit. It's mostly as is, but if you need to stray, that's totally.
Yeah, cool. I just don't know.
We'll get on track.
Like to sound relatively intelligent.
Oh, come on, jeez. So let's go back to this thought. So
I've been accused of false modesty, but when the truth is, I'm just deeply neurotic.
No, I totally understand.
Profoundly insecure. But yeah.
The number of authors who suffer from imposter syndrome are quite high.
I'm just still thinking about, you know, your original question, because you sort of, I don't know.
We're talking about, like, you know, the quest for moral heft.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that this originates from the same desire to not bore yourself, just as you're driven to extreme situations. You also want the fantastical element to mean something by imbuing it in some sense with, like, something related to Jewishness.
Well,
is that safe to say?
Or? Yeah. And I guess it's a distinctly Jewish magic that, you know, that I resonate to. And there's a Malamud story that I like called Man in a Drawer. And he meets a Russian author, you know, and it's during the Soviet era, and the guy is writing stories that are imbued with Jewish content.
Yeah.
And he's grown up without, you know, where Judaism itself is suppressed, he's had no primary experience of it, and yet the stories are exclusively about Jews. And, you know, the narrator says, well, why? And he says, when I think Jews come stories, you know. And I'm afraid, you know, it's mea culpa for me too. You know, I've had conversations with other Jewish authors, you know, who say, do you think you'll always write about Jews exclusively? And several of them have stopped, you know, and thought, you know, this is a dead end.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe thinking commercially or something that, you know, I have a friend who grew up in a Hasidic family, and her early books were about that world and breaking with it as well, but it really, you know, just suffused and informed by it. And she said to me, you drop the Jewish stuff, you know, and I'm getting too close to naming names here, but her last book was anything but. And it was not a success, you know, nearly the kind of following she had when she was writing about what she knew best.
Yeah.
And with me, I mean, I only know it best through books. I read a lot of books, and I live in books
a lot.
And that's,
you live in books more than you live in life?
Well, I, you know, as for life, my servants can do that for me. No, but that's one of those inescapable dichotomies that I was talking about, you know, where there's experience versus imagination. And I think that, yeah, I mean, that's a theme that's been sort of fundamental for me. And my characters play that one out in various ways. And sometimes, you know, there's, well, I mean, I think of examples, you know, in the work. A character like Zelig Rifkin,
yeah,
who is, you know, he's a misfit. And an unhappy character on Earth who manages to climb this tree beneath which the neighborhood sleeps during these infernally hot days in summer. And so he enters the zone of the collective dream life of the community. And
his standing actually rises the more that he is cognizant of these dreams.
Right. And he's able to meddle a bit,
yes,
you know, and of course, you know, finds himself with a kind of power and a kind of license that, you know, he certainly doesn't possess on Earth.
Yeah.
So there comes finally a moment when a choice must be made, you know.
I'm glad you bring up this story, because I wanted to talk with you about the sort of strange voyeuristic element I see in a number of these stories. Of course, with Zelig, we have you know what I mentioned, which is his, you know, standing in the community rises and falls. You got Mushi Mumser's his inability to talk, or even the Sin of Elijah, where he writes at the beginning, "You might say that observing the passions of mortals, often with stern disapproval, had always been a hobby of mine." So, you know, I'm wondering, is the idea here to juxtapose human faith with religious faith? Why do you think that observation is this recurring point for you, especially when it's aligned with the imagination like this?
You are a very good reader and a very good questioner. And, you know, these are questions that I should go home and, you know, meditate on. But I mean, what immediately comes to mind is just this notion of the outsider,
yeah,
you know, and which my characters often are. And I think most writers, you know, if you quiz them, are going to insist that, you know, that theirs is an outsider vantage, you know, and that it allows a certain distance and a certain kind of objectivity. And I think that's true.
Yeah.
But there's also a sense of, you know, the solitary and that ambivalence of wanting, you know, to make connections, to enter community, but not being able to fit. And you know, for me personally, maybe it comes back to this idea of not having grown up in the kinds of communities that I write about,
yeah,
and feeling a, you know, a real affection for them, and but it's an affection in the abstract, and, you know, and
or the outsider is a better place and a more comfortable place for you to begin a story, because you have direct personal connection with which to explore the foreign or the or something that you don't quite know nearly as well as you would like to.
Thank you. And, you know, when characters like Elijah or even Zelig, you know, do begin to enter into authentic experience, they often fuck it up, you know, in somewhat disastrous ways.
Well, how so?
And I'm trying to remember, you know, it's funny because these stories are over, you know,
a lot of them are long. Yeah, you collected them from previous collections.
Quarter of a century old. And when I got the volume, I saw that my God, all these characters are flying away. You know?
The disembodied qualities. Yes, I was going to mention that too.
And, you know, whoa.
Talk about the ultimate outsider experience.
Exactly. Exactly. And the disembodiment and flight from, you know, the familiar. So what was, where were
you? Oh, well, we were talking about the notion of an outsider being a comfortable place, and you were running with the ball with us, and then we started thinking about you know, the fact that there are all these disembodied characters.
Well, and you know, basically, it's that real life experience has consequences, you know, and real community is complicated and messy, and you know, and these are characters who are able to, you know, embrace, maybe embody a certain purity from the outside, but it's a purity that is in danger of a sterility as well, unless the connection is made. And I'm talking paradox again, you know, but I...
But the paradox creates conflict, you know?
Yeah.
Even in something that is a very select or limited audience, which I think your stories are as well. I mean, you know, you were saying...
Sad to say.
Well, why do you think that is? I mean, do you think that's just... If you embrace complete outsiderhood, that this is going to be your fate as a writer? This is inevitable? Or do you think that, you know, there is a way in? Or I mean, you know, what has been your experience? It seems that you have people like me who have come across your work, but you know, should this even matter to you as a writer? Any kind of readership, any kind of audience, or
I think it's impossible for it not to matter. You know?
Does it matter to you?
Of course it does. I'd be a hypocrite if I said otherwise. You know, and truth be known, I've always thought of myself as an entertainer.
Yeah.
You know, and I love, you know, a thumping good yarn. I'm a storyteller, you know. I'm not an idea guy. My work is not driven so much by theme as it is by story and image and character. And I'm happy to sacrifice, to bend, fold, and spindle a theme in any way that the story insists on. And no, I don't write for the drawer. I do write for, you know, my fellow species. But I think that maybe, I mean, you know, writers that don't have audiences can concoct all kinds of theories and justifications of why they don't have audiences, you know.
I mean, have you ever actively sought an audience? Have you written something deliberately entertaining to try to calculate the odds or anything like that?
Oh, I like I say, when I write a story, it's certainly intended to please. And there's a way in which, you know, you're not just expressing dreams, you know, that there is this middle ground between the dream and the communication of that dream, which has to have form and it has to have characters and it has to mean something. And so in that respect, you know, yeah, I'm thinking about a reader, but I'm also aware, and I've been made painfully aware, you know, over the decades that you know, in writing the kinds of stories that I myself want to read, my taste is not is not to everyone's taste.
Sure.
And I also think that, you know, my friends who have been, you know, saturated their work in Jewish content and found that they were ghettoized as writers and have tried to write outside it, you know, have been moved and motivated by that fact, you know, that issue, and that the exclusive Jewishness, you know, of a story can really limit your audience, you know. And I'm always, you know, impressed by authors that have managed to sort of transcend the, you know, the ethnicity.
But is there anything you could really do to combat that exclusiveness? I mean, yeah, other writers.
Maybe use fewer Yiddish words.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know,
there is a glossary.
Yeah, there is a glossary in the back.
It's a short one.
A few I didn't know, which was thank you. So, yeah. But I mean, you know, when you saturate a story in Yiddish words or language or customs, do you feel that the present American fiction landscape is less forgiving or less inclusive of that particular story? And you're kind of... Yeah, here's another paradox. You have to write true to that world, but on the other hand, it creates a sort of it creates an exclusive buffer to some degree, and it insulates against other people possibly discovering this. I mean, you know, is there anything you could really do to combat that, or is it just that's the only way in because of this period where you just saturate yourself in folklore and customs and books?
Well,
and so forth?
You know, I mean, for better or worse, that's my passion.
Yeah,
And it's what fuels my imagination, and if I move outside it, you know, the stories would lack the kind of vitality, you know, that I need,
yeah,
you know, to motivate me. So no, finally, there is nothing, and I also, you know, believe in the sort of Joycean adage, you know, that in the particular is the universal.
Yes.
You know, so you. You know, you focus on a world that you feel that you do in some sense understand, you know, and hope that if the vision is genuine, then it will resonate universally. Well, not always the case, you know. And so I blame myself.
Yeah. Let's move on to Memphis. We were talking about it earlier. I was really fascinated by the pinch. I've never been to Memphis, so I'm providing a certain amount of faith in you to actually give me a fairly accurate answer. But the district in Memphis, the pinch, that factors into many of your Memphis stories. How close would you say this is to the pinch that you grew up with? I mean, you have, for example, Lazar suggesting that it's almost an open grave. I'm wondering, does the pinch work because there's this idea that it for better or worse, this is all there is for the people who live there. You know, how did this idea of the pinch come up? How did you stumble upon this? And do you feel that this is an appropriate representation or an accurate representation of the pinch that you knew when you were in Memphis?
Yeah, well, I didn't, in a word. And I never heard of it and growing up. And you know, it wasn't a place when I was a kid that you would have visited anyway because it was in decline. And, you know, the Jews were pretty much gone shortly after World War II. You know, that the first generation had, you know, their kids had grown up, gone to war, they'd come back.
Yeah.
Established businesses out east, moved the families, the synagogues moved. So there, you know, there were a handful of Jewish relics on North Main Street that would not have caught your eye.
Was there an actual Green Owl Cafe? I did actually Google this out of curiosity.
There was a Green Owl Cafe.
Yeah,
on Poplar. It wasn't technically in the pinch. When I discovered the place, very desolate, you know, vacant lots, ridge ramps, you know, crumbling buildings.
Your sad cafe. Did you get Carson McCullers into this?
Well, had it been there even. But the only sort of distinctly Jewish relic there was one synagogue. There had been five at one point. This is the Anshe Mishnah, which had been very, you know, sort of ultra-Orthodox synagogue, had been converted to the Rainbow Club, which was a transvestite nightclub where men dressed as ladies would dance in the old ritual bath, you know. And so that was it. So, you know, my answer is that I had no knowledge of the place growing up. There probably were more vestiges when I was a kid, but again, no reason to go down there.
Yeah.
And so it really was when I began to do the interviews and I take the voices and the stories to that, you know, blighted street and was able to begin to reassemble it. And, you know, it was a dramatic moment for me because it really did feel like this sort of massive salvage operation, you know, like you're bringing the lost continent of Atlantis up from the bottom of the sea, and I'm going to set my stories here, and this is, you know, this is my Odessa, this is my Dublin, this is my Dickensian London, you know, this is my Yakna Potofa County, I own it, you know, and so I began.
As far as I know, nobody else is writing about the pinch.
Not so, but I...
Who else is writing about the
book? Well, Tova Mervis, who is a young woman who grew up in an ultra-Orthodox community in Memphis. And her mother was my age, in fact. And we were kids together, and she bit me really badly.
Really?
Tova Mervis's mother bit me. So anyway, that's a...
Wait, so the mother bit you and the daughter is making you write your own stories.
The daughter reads books that, you know, everybody in Memphis reads.
This is a pure family vengeance here. Yeah. So you got this character named Saul Bozoff in The Wedding Jester. And he sounds an awful lot like the Steve Stern who I'm talking with right now. He's got this fiction career in which he's seduced by heritage, oral history.
All coincidence.
Yeah, all coincidence. Well, I mean, I was wondering about this because why did you feel compelled to be a little bit more transparent about yourself with that story? I mean, there is, of course, the disembodied conclusion, but, you know, I'm wondering, you know, was the disembodied way, the disembodied conclusion a way for you to keep yourself in line here?
Well, Saul reappears, you know, with some frequency in other stories.
Yes.
And so I've used him as an alter ego here and in there.
He's your Zuckerman?
Kind of. I mean, there's a long story in the Laser Malkin collection, which was the first collection of pinch stories.
Yes.
And for which the survivors of the pinch were so grateful to, you know, my mythologization of the neighborhood that they sued me for $250,000.
I had heard something about this. How did this come about? I mean, it's fiction, right?
Yeah,
how could you get sued for this?
I used the name of a living character.
I see.
And, you know, I could not resist it. It was a great name. I had no idea who was alive and who wasn't.
You found out rather quickly.
And I did. She had a sort of, you know, the character that's based, that uses her name, eats a barbecue sandwich in her father's kosher home. You know, it's pork barbecue. And being a good Jewish daughter, you know, she got her ambulance chasing son to to sue me, and
was the suit settled or what happened here?
Oh, it was a farce. I mean, the New York attorneys essentially frightened the the Memphis attorneys, but the book was sort of made to disappear, you know.
Really?
And I was banished to the outer dark where I reside to this day.
Wow, so because of this litigation, which seemed to be accidental upon your part, the accidental inclusion of a name, you feel that this is directly responsible for how your fiction career has gone in the last...
I'm exaggerating.
Okay.
I think I'm pretty much solely responsible, but I would like to be able to blame it on Faggy Dubrovner, for those of you who are listening. That's her name, and I've actually found a way to get even.
Really?
You know, being a sort of small, petty little man, I learned that the Presley family, when they first came to Memphis, and they were in line to get a apartment in a housing project that was being built in Memphis. Poor folks. But while they were waiting, they rented rooms in the home of the Dubrovner family. They're being very pious family. They would hire a Shabbos goy on Friday nights, you know, to come and, you know, turn the lights off and on, wash the dishes, tear the toilet paper.
Yeah.
Well, young Elvis was, in fact, their Shabbos goy. And I think that Faggy would have been about the same age, a little older, you know, and Elvis trembling on the brink of adolescence. So I'm convinced that she initiated him into the mysteries of the flesh. And possibly there's even a child.
Wow.
The bastard son of Elvis Presley.
The dark side of Steve Stern.
That's a rumor that I've been spreading, you know.
Through. I wanted also to talk about the man who would be Kafka. It concerns itself with how the rules...
You know, I don't think I've fully answered a single question.
No. It's totally fine. We're getting answers, actually.
Okay.
So you got the man who would be Kafka. It concerns itself with how the rules of a seemingly inflexible narrative can be bent simply, in this case, you know, Kafka's before the law from the trial. Only a reader who can just intervene and claim that, you know, he sees certain things, and therefore the rules don't necessarily apply to his interpretation. The idea of Yossel claiming that it was only Gregor at the story's end suggests that that stories are very vulnerable to this idea of people who are reading and discussing them. How do you think stories endure? Do you think that you have to respect the initial folklore, or does fiction have to change the rules or adapt with the times? You know, what's up with this issue? And it seems to me that you were thinking about this when writing this story.
Yeah, again, I mean, I think your questions are wonderful, and I wish that, you know, I had the wherewithal to answer them as well as they deserve to be answered, but I'm a real sort of devotee of trickster tales in folklore, and, you know, even before I became a Yiddophile, you know, I mean, I read stories about Native American, you know, the coyote, or... You know,
we may need another word besides Yiddophile. It's close to something else, but... Sorry.
Yeah. You know, Loki in Scandinavian folklore, Hermes, or Eulenspiegel, you know, the Germans. And so when I began to read the Yiddish folklore and discovered that, whoa... The Jews have got them too, you know, these trickster characters.
Of course they do. And, in many cases, they were plucked from the Jews.
Well, yeah. And, I mean, the characters like Herschel Ostropolia or Maka Chabad, who were historical jesters in these Hasidic courts. They had their own jesters, for God's sake. And their antics... It was sort of translated into legend. And so you have these cycles of tales. And so I find that I'm often drawn to characters who fulfill that trickster function, which is essentially to live outside of convention, outside of morality, and to turn it on its head and to subvert it. I was talking to somebody about this the other night, and you know, and talking about how, well, the subversion is for the sake of making a tradition new, or allowing you to see it from a fresh vantage, and to even maybe redeem it in some ways. And so I'm saying all this and thinking, you know, I'm not sure I really believe this.
Yeah.
And I think that maybe my impulse to subvert is just pure irreverence, you know. And in the case of Kafka, whose work I reverence absolutely, I think that Kafka was incapable of saying, of uttering a word that wasn't the truth of the human soul. No, I think his vision was that clear, and he was that free of illusion. But at the same time, that parable, you know, before the law, which everyone who knows Kafka knows, you know, the old man who, you know, he sits outside the palace of the law his entire life, and then, you know, at the very end of his life, it's revealed to him that this was the door that was for him exclusively, and now I'm going to shut it.
Yes.
And in some ways, I feel like that parable is at the heart of modern literature, you know, the door is shut, we can't get into the palace of the law, we're all exiled, we're all alien, you know, and so in a story, you know, you can posit a character who runs between the legs of the guard, who steals the tablets of the law, leaps out the window, and he's off, you know, and this is what I guess I mean by having it both ways. So when you have a character like, what's his name? Metzger? Metz, I forget the name of my character in.
I think so.
Something
yes.
like that. Anyway, for him, Kafka is the role model, you know, as he has been the role model for virtually all serious, you know, Western literature, you know, since he first wrote. You can't not escape the shadow of Franz Kafka, except maybe in a story, you know.
Yes.
So I think that's
fiction creates its own loopholes, then, to respond to previous maxims laid down by the masters.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what that story's about,
yeah.
you know. And also, I mean, it's another example of me kind of bootlegging figures out of literature into the realm of ordinary experience,
yeah.
you know. And, you know, so that's a whimsical tale, and it actually has a happy ending. It's not a thing that happens often in my stories. You know, if I could see a way to capture some kind of affirmation at the end of the story, I'll do it. But it's not often that happens.
You were mentioning irreverence earlier, and I have to talk with you about one of my favorite stories in the book, which is Legend of the Lost, where it starts off with this guy who goes on a bungee cord ride, and the bungee cord breaks, and he literally loses his soul. And you have a series of calamity after calamity after calamity.
Resulting in the end of the world.
Yes. He ends up as this pimp. And this may go back to, you know, because you were feeling a little contrite about not answering my initial query, I'm going to try to go back to that with this particular story. I was wondering, when you wrote this, you know, stacking up the calamities, was that more of interest to you? Or were you trying to figure out, like, well, what would an existence be like where you had no soul, no sense of empathy, no sense of going around and caring for other people, which this character does certainly has. You know, the motivation for that story, was it shits and giggles, or were you really trying to find that thematic way in?
I was really in a dark mood, I think. And, you know, in fact, I think that the new stories, they're not chronologically arranged, but the new ones tend to be darker than the old. And I don't know why that's the case. I don't think I'm any more miserable or pessimistic or fatalistic than I've been, you know, my entire life. In fact, maybe less so. But
it has to come out somewhere, I guess.
Yeah, but if you deprive a character of his soul in a story, then you're also, in a sense, I think, obliged to paint a picture of a world that becomes finally as soulless as that character. And so that's what those graduated calamities finally lead to.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's...
It really is a scorched earth or a scorched flesh situation.
Yeah. And I had, you know, that's the impulse to take things, I guess, to their farthest extremity, you know, in the most logical and illogical conclusion.
Yeah.
You know, a place where maybe logic and illogic, you know, are married to one another. And then a sort of a last-minute redemption. And again, you know, I'm talking about stories that I'm a long way from,
yeah.
you know, and so forgive me if I don't remember all the details, but that's he does discover his soul at
yes.
the end, which has been, it's sort of tucked like an old dead leaf in
yes.
this book.
Through a complete fluke by as well, yes.
Yeah, and he finds it in one of the caves,
yeah.
and that I'd hoped that the connection with the Qumran caves where the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered would
yeah.
you know would be somewhat apparent to, you know, a reader as scrupulous as yourself.
Well, I mean, but the thing about that story is the tension between fulfilling perhaps some need to tied into Jewish identity and also just having fun. That to me is that tension is what I think I really, that's why I really like that story quite a bit. You know, and I'm wondering if,
well, identity in that,
yeah,
in that frame,
yeah,
is about a connection with a spiritual dimension.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, remove the soul and any access to the spiritual is not available. And so the consequences, you know, are they sort of come with ever-increasing returns. And, you know, again, it was my impulse, I suppose, you know, I'm stretching to try to recall these impulses, but this sense of, well, in a world that, you know, with a character bereft of any spiritual dimension, in a world that is equally bereft, you know, what, you know, what's the upshot? Is there any possibility? Is there any ground for hope, you know?
But should fiction really be answering that question of whether there's any possibility for hope or finality? I mean, you know, some people would argue that fiction really shouldn't have a neat and tidy bow for every story.
Well, it isn't. There is a kind of tidiness at the end,
yeah,
but it's a paradoxical tidiness,
yes,
you know. And I keep coming back to that word, I know, and, you know, that's... that is the essence of Franz Kafka's fiction, you know. It's all paradox. I think of one of his short parables where he sort of imagines a character who is a citizen of the earth and, you know, the inheritor of all the possibilities that, you know, that are inherent in the earth, but is chained to heaven.
Yes.
And so he can't entirely appreciate the earth for his connection to the sublime.
Yes.
So he's actually sabotaged in a way, or compromised by his connection to the spiritual world, while at the same time, you know, he is a citizen of heaven.
Yes.
With all of the advantages, you know, of that sublime element, but the chain that doesn't allow him to partake entirely, you know, of the things of the world,
yeah,
you know, ordinary human experience, sensuous experience, you know, other human beings. And that speaks to me, that paradox, you know. And I think my misfits are often in the same predicament, same dilemma.
Well, on that note of paradox and misfits and endings that may not be entirely conclusive, let's end this conversation. But Steve, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
Oh, well, yeah. Likewise.
Fantastic.
I mean, your questions are marvelous, and I don't feel that I'm doing justice to them, but maybe someday.
By, and I don't know where I'm going.